Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. Now this week we have an excellent guest and we have some wonderful new music. But before we get onto all of that, some of you will have seen this on social media, but for those who haven't seen it, even just the audio, it's fun.
Sinclair delivers from the set play. Who's attacking it? It's off the inside of the post and it's in. It's Moussa Dembélé who breaks the deadlock at Celtic Park. Here's Dembélé, the man who got that goal. He's shown a good touch as well. He's got his second of the afternoon. Well, Senderas dives in. Dembélé just drags it back and he conjures up the coolest of finishes. Forrest works it in again for Moussa Dembélé. Oh, he's found his strike partner in the other ball's in the net with the offside flag, surely. Nope. Senderas just gets pushed there by the Celtic front man. He handled it.
Yeah, it looks like
things have just got worse.
Yes.
Lustig. Is there a hat trick? There is now. Dembélé claims his third of the afternoon. There's Tierney. There's Armstrong now. 91 minutes on the clock.
I hope you enjoyed that little interlude. I thought since we were playing new music from a Glasgow band called The Snuts, and this song is called Glasgow, that we should have a bit of audio from a Glasgow derby. So that's what we did. Anyway, let's move on to this week's guest on the podcast. We have chat that ranges from Rudolf Hess being arrested to a boxer having to pick a hair out of his backside for drugs testing, through to being a member of the Brisbane Celtic Supporters Club, playing rugby in Strathaven. How wonderful Celtic are to watch at the moment, and all things in between. If you are interested in boxing, this will be a fascinating podcast. If you're not interested in boxing, this is a great podcast just to get an insight into some of the things that happens in professional sport. So this week's guest is Matt Clark. Many of you follow him on Twitter. He is manager of Lucas Brown, who was world heavyweight champion for 2.5 weeks and might be again. And the story of that is all contained in this podcast. Anyway, I will not keep you listening any longer. The new music is from a band called The Snuts. This is Glasgow playing Underneath at the moment. And after the our chat with Matt Clark, it will be the other song playing will be Proper by The Snuts, and I'll put Glasgow on again. Anyway, enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Matt Clark. So I'm joined now by Matt Clark, that many of you will follow on Twitter and know from us on Twitter. And rather than me give his biography, if you don't know him, and even if you do know him, I thought it would be better if Matt did it himself. So, Matt, what is a guy born in Australia, living in Australia, doing being a mad Celtic fan?
It's not much of a biography, I've got to admit, but I was born and raised in Australia. My granddad immigrated to Australia after World War II. I've always known about Celtic. I've always known about my Scottish heritage and things like that. So one thing just led to another, and here I am. Waking up at 4:30 in the morning to watch Celtic and staying up till midnight another night. So, yeah.
Well, before, I mean, I'll get into the meat of that in a minute, but before we start with anything, you do have to let people know what you do for a living in terms of your connection to sport that you do for a living.
That's true. Look, I manage boxers, professional fighters here in Australia. The most, I would say, famous of who is Lucas Brown, who is world-ranked at heavyweight, was the WBA heavyweight champion, was stripped of that title, very, very dubious circumstances. Apart from him, I've managed a couple of 2012 Olympians, Damien Hooper and Cameron Hammond, and also Brandon Ogilvie, who's world-ranked at lightweight, and various other boxers as well, just on the domestic Australian scene.
We'll get on to specifically Lucas Brown in a minute, because that's a really interesting one for those of us who like our boxing. But first up, before we can get anybody talking about anything on the Celtic Underground podcast, we have to know, what was your first Celtic game, which is obviously a bit of a challenge? Well, you can give me two. What was your first Celtic game you can think of, and what was the first Celtic game you actually attended, and who was your first Celtic hero?
Geez, that is a good question. The first game that I attended in person was in the 2000-2001 season. It was the Scottish Cup quarter-final at Paradise. Celtic won 1-0, Henrik Larsson a header. The first game that I can recall, and I'm not even sure I can recall that, because I've always just known about Celtic. We've always had highlights here and things like that. So in terms of specific games that I can remember, not entirely sure. I do remember being really interested when we stopped the 10, obviously. Yeah. That was news here in Australia. That was big news. That was probably one of the seasons. I was probably about 16 at that time, I think, where I really started to get involved in following Celtic. So it was a good year to start following, obviously.
Yeah. So, and did you, if you're a bit older, did you have any Celtic heroes? Did you? I mean, obviously, you've mentioned Henrik. Is there anybody else?
I loved Neil Lennon. I was playing rugby in Scotland for a couple of years in my early 20s, and if you've ever seen me play football, you know why I play rugby, because I can't. But I was over in Scotland, and I thought the abuse that Neil Lennon copped up and down the country was just, you know, that wouldn't get passed here in Australia. You wouldn't be allowed to really do that, I don't think. And I really admired the man for his tenacity, and the abuse that he copped week in, week out, you know, at away grounds, I think was, and for him to be able to put up with that was admirable, and for him to fight back, I think, was tremendous. So he was someone who I always respected.
So if I go right back to the beginning, you said your granddad arrived just after the war, it would have been?
Yeah, that's right. He was a coal miner when he was a young fella in Les Mahaga in Lanarkshire, and was too young to be involved in World War II, but was part of the occupational forces in Berlin. After the war, he was in the RAF just as a messenger, I think, riding motorcycles and things like that. And I think after World War II, he decided, no, I'm going to try somewhere else. And it was between Australia and Canada. And Australia it was. He moved out to Ipswich, which is a coal mining city, probably 20 minutes west of Brisbane. Got a job in the pits straight away, obviously. Met my grandmother at a dance, parish dance, and they were married about 3 weeks later, I think, something like that.
So I can... Oh, there's one other interesting thing before we move on to that. Your great-granddad was part of the Home Guard who arrested Rudolf Hess. Now, I think many people know, although it's a story that sort of over time diminishes, for those people not aware, Rudolf Hess came across to, for some reason, in a plane and crash-landed. He seems to have turned up in about five different places, all on the sort of south side. So crash landed round about Eelsham, was taken to a scout hut in Giffnock. So your great granddad was part of that team?
He was. He was in the home guard, too old to fight. And as you said, Hess crash landed and parachuted out. And my great-granddad was the second on the scene there, I think. There was some young fellas that were there first, but he outranked them. And I think in one of Hess's books, he said that my great-granddad walked in with a distinct smell of whiskey on his breath and was brandishing a revolver and shouted hands up with apparently such authority that even the Scottish farmers at Eaglesham put their hands up. He then took control of Hess, apparently, and it says in a couple of books that he was fairly rough with him, which I think was great. It took him away to the scouts hall, like you said, to be interrogated. But at that time, he didn't know who Hess was or anything like that. So it wasn't something that my dad says it wasn't something that he really spoke about too much, actually. He wasn't into bragging about it, but obviously it's a great story for us to tell now.
Yeah, it certainly is. So I can understand modern technology. You know, we can see each other on Skype at the moment. You can keep in contact. You know, you get up and you can tell me your circumstance of watching Celtic games. So you get up at 4 in the morning and watch a Celtic game. But that's now. How did your family manage to keep up to date with Celtic news for the 50, 60 years when that wasn't so easy?
It didn't happen, I don't think. The odd letter. Occasionally you'd get something in the paper, I would imagine, for the big games. I don't think it simply happened back then. It's just too far. Australia, you couldn't get any further away from Scotland. So I know they used to keep in touch with my relatives that were still on the farm and obviously through letters, but you're talking like a month for a letter to arrive. So it's old news by the time you get away. Modern technology, it's incredible. Like everything's instant. We get all the games live pretty much. Anything that's on BT Sport, we get over here through beIN Sport, which is fantastic. So, and if you don't, obviously if you don't have it on TV, you can always find a way through the internet and things like that, Celtic TV, all the rest of it.
So do you just watch at home or do you meet up with a
group? Yeah, usually I'm on the Sunshine Coast, which is about an hour north of Brisbane. I'm a member of the Brisbane Celtic Supporters Club. When I was in Ipswich, it was only half an hour to Brisbane, so it's no problem there at all. But usually I watch at home. But if it's a big game and she must be obeyed permits, I'll go down to Brisbane and have a few there.
So tell me more about your day job, for want of a better way of putting it, and particularly tell me about Lucas Brown. And for those not aware, the heavyweight scene in boxing was pretty stable for a decade or so. It was the Klitschko's that owned everything. And then as that's come to an end, it's fragmented. We've had Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, and obviously your boy. So tell us what was so special about your boy winning it, and then tell us everything, all the shit that hit the fan thereafter.
Oh, how long have you got?
Well, exactly. It's still ongoing, I know.
Okay, so Big Lucas, he's 6'4", 6'5". He's a big boy. He's 115 kilos. And he's been climbing the ranks very slowly, but we eventually got to a mandatory spot for the WBA heavyweight title, and that was against Ruslan Chagaev. It worked out that the fight was going to be in Chechnya, of all places. And we went there back in March, and he fought there, and he was behind on points. He was doing really well. He was boxing and showing a bit of movement and that sort of stuff, which is not something you'd actually associate with him because he's normally sort of one of those guys that likes to plant his feet and swing for the hills. But he was boxing along and doing well. He got dropped in the sixth round.
Is he 35? Is that right?
I think he's 37 now. Yeah, he's 36 at the time. He's a late bloomer, though. He's only started fighting since he was 30. So he used to be a Parramatta Eels junior. He was playing on the wing for rugby league and Parramatta Eels. So he's a talented sportsman, and he got to the age of 30 and thought, well, if I'm going to do something with myself, I might as well do it now. So we went over to Chechnya, and he was dropped heavily in the sixth round, showed a lot of heart and courage to keep fighting on, and then in the 10th round, out of nowhere, lands a right hand on Chagaev and dropped him. And we all went ballistic, obviously, and Lucas followed it up and landed about 20 unanswered punches. And eventually the referee intervened and said, that's enough. And I went ballistic and jumped the ropes and I was lucky not to fall on my face. But the rest of the crowd you could hear a pin drop. Like, there was probably 8,000 or 9,000 people there, and every single one of them except for seven of us were going for Lucas Brown. And in that seven, I include Lucas Brown too. But
because in terms of what this was, you'd met the president before the fight, hadn't you?
That's right, yeah. Ramzan Kadyrov, his name is. He's got a few write-ups about him on Wiki and places like that where he's, fairly controversial, to say the least. I think he's got some human rights issues going on, according to some people, and all the rest of it. And we met him the night, 2 days before the fight, and we were doing a press thing, and Lucas was shadow boxing and that sort of thing, just for the cameras. It was nothing more than that. And Kadyrov came up to him and just landed this right hand right to the pit of his stomach as hard as he could. And, we were laughing, saying, like, it's hard to imagine the Prime Minister of Australia or whatever coming up to a sportsman and punching them in the gut. They could, but we just sort of grinned and thought, ooh, this is different. it was a wild place. Like, the people were friendly. The people were very, very friendly. We were treated like rock stars over there. Lucas had his face on billboards and everything, and everyone knew who we were, obviously. But there was also, you had to be a little bit cautious as well. There's, our government advises you not to travel there under any circumstances. And
yeah, because they've had an issue with Muslim, depending on how you want to word it, Muslim terrorists issues much longer than the West has been dealing with it. So
that's right. I'm not going to pretend I'm up to speed with much of that, but I do know that they're very anti-ISIS. That's what we were explained to us by our minders, and they actually have checks. So we'd be driving to the gym, and at every set of traffic lights, they'd have soldiers there that would go looking through your windows to make sure that you weren't an extremist, I suppose, for lack of better words. And then where we were training was actually at the president's compound, and you would go through three different sets of guards, all of them brandishing sort of like machine guns with grenade launchers on the bottom of them and all sorts of stuff. So day one, you kind of really, well, this is different, but after you're there for 7 days, as bizarre as it sounds, you don't even blink an eye. It just becomes normal. We had an armed guard. We're on the 23rd floor of Hotel Grozny there, and we had armed guards wherever we were. They were actually staying on our level, so we had the level to ourselves, and they sat by the elevator 24 hours a day. And we thought that was kind of strange, because they're sitting there with Glocks and all this sort of stuff. And my dad went over to ask one of them for a photo because he had a gun, obviously, and it was just something completely different. We don't see these sort of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And and obviously my dad doesn't speak a word of Chechen, and the guard didn't speak a word of English, but he misinterpreted what my dad was asking for and actually handed him his gun. And now my dad's a retired school teacher. He's probably used to handling a piece of chalk or something like that. So he was out of his depth there. But within about sort of 5 minutes of him walking around holding this gun, I think he was thinking he was the 63-year-old Australian version of Francis Hughes or something like that. So, it was an experience. But we go to the markets. We actually got out and about. Like, other people that have fought there, Shugai has fought a couple of guys there. Mm-hmm. And they used to just stay in the hotel to themselves and keep to themselves. But we got out and about. We met the people, went down to the markets, and, were talking, and everyone was getting photos and all that sort of stuff. And secretly people would come up to us very quietly and say, I hope you win, to Lucas. And they'd say, don't say anything, but I hope you win. So Shugayev is really, really the people's fighter over there. It was a big thing when we stopped him. You could literally hear a pin drop.
Yeah, so that's why I wanted to go back to that before. So you were at the point where you'd leapt into the ring and you'd not broken your neck.
Just.
Yeah. Was there any concern at that point, and we'll get into what happened, was there any concern at that point about winning when you're permanently surrounded by guys with machine guns?
Yeah, absolutely. If you actually ever get to watch the replay or whatever on YouTube, you'll see me jump in the ring, and Lucas sort of throws his hands up in the air and shouts yes, or words to that effect. And I think really, really quickly, everyone cottoned on, hang on a sec, we're in Chechnya here, and this isn't the popular results. As soon as the referee waved the contest off, the president stood up and was just shouting obviously his displeasure at the decision. And everyone sort of went, oh, this isn't great. We're a long way from Australia at the moment. But look, we got to hand it to them. Like they were upset at the decision and they were quiet, but we never had any bother whatsoever. Not anything there anyway. Nothing physical or anything.
You didn't find your arm guard disappeared on the way back to the airport or anything?
No, they were fine. They were fine. In fact, we said to them after Katerov hit Lucas in the stomach, we said, where were you on that one? You know, you're meant to be looking after us. And one of them said through the interpreter, if that man hits you once, I hit you twice.
So, Lucas becomes the first Australian world heavyweight champion.
Yeah, for 2.5 weeks.
Yeah. So that's the bit that not everybody listening to this podcast will know about. So what happens next?
Right. Okay. So 2.5 weeks later, I'm in Scotland actually on holidays, and I'm with my old man. We were doing a little tour of Scotland and Ireland, mostly for the centenary celebrations of 1916. And we were in the Highlands, and the news came through that he'd failed a test for clenbuterol, which is, well, I didn't really know what clenbuterol was at the time. To be honest, I'd heard of it, didn't know what it was. It's a weight stripper basically, and I thought, oh, really, this can't be right. And obviously, I was calling Lucas, and I think it might have been 4 a.m. there, and I told him and broke the news to him, and he didn't know what was going on either, especially because I called him at that time of the day. But long story short, we did a test on the Monday, or Lucas did a test, I should say, on the Monday, both blood and urine, and that was completely clear. So he then failed a post-fight test, which is directly after the fight, which came back for trace elements of clenbuterol. So we knew something was amiss because we went through everything he ate, every supplement, every vitamin, everything he took, and he's just not that sort of guy. And to be clear of a weight stripper on the Monday and be dirty on the Saturday when you're a heavyweight and you can weigh whatever you want makes no sense at all. And
I was going to say, because is that the only real benefit of this drug?
It's also a bronchiolator, I think it is, which apparently can give greater oxygen through your lungs or into your blood or something like that. But we engaged in a... an expert who said it would give you the same amount of energy boost as a can of, you know, V or Rockstar or one of those sort of Red Bull drinks. So we obviously got on the front foot and said that something's amiss here, and sent hair samples from Lucas, which we had to get from his underarms because he hasn't got a hair on his head.
But, do you know, you mentioned to me you'd get hair samples. And I know he's bald, and it never entered my head as to where you're going to get a hair sample from a bald man.
Right. So we sent those off to America, and to be tested, because I didn't know this, but the root of your hair is kind of like when you cut down a tree and you can see the rings inside the tree and say how old the tree is. Well, it's the same with the root in your hair. You can see how long something's been in your system for, which I had no idea. And the testing came back that they can conclusively say that the amount that was in his system was consistent with one dosage and was definitely not in his system prior to his arrival in Chechnya. So we were like, well, pardon my French, but I think we've been fucked here. We're not sure where it happened, but we're not sure exactly how it happened, but we were eating obviously every meal over there. And, you know, I've seen some comments on Twitter and the like saying, well, you should have, you know, Tyson Fury brought all his meals to Germany and this and that. And I'm like, yeah, but we didn't go to Germany. We went to Chechnya. Like, it's not easy. No. I don't think too many things lived to Chechnya.
No, it's and not only that, you'd be taking it in for your whole training camp, and, you know, a heavyweight boxer is going to eat a lot of food.
Oh, look, he wasn't worried about his weight. He knew he was in great condition, and like I said, he was eating mountains of food because he burns it off. He's such a big boy. And, none of it made any sense. His last opponent, Chigayev's last opponent, Fraser Quendo, I believe, tested positive to a breast cancer medicine or something like that. So it's, Yeah, it's, you know, look, I can't say who did it and who definitely didn't do it or anything like that. None of us can, but we know that he entered Chechnya clean and came out dirty. And I can assure you, none of us were willing to take any of that sort of stuff through Australian and Russian customs, because I don't think that's worth your while.
No.
So, no, it was an absolute mess. So, long story, like after that, we took the WBA stripped him without hearing our side of the equation, I suppose. Like, they didn't allow us to present our evidence. We hired Leon Margulies, who's a boxing promoter in America, but also an attorney. So he put together a case, and yeah, the WBA made a decision. We took them to court, as is the want in boxing, I suppose, that happens a bit, and we settled out of court. So his next, while he doesn't have the belt now, his next fight will be for the same title that he should really have around his waist anyway. So it was either that or we sit in court for another two and a half years. And, you know, he's 37 and in the prime of his career. He doesn't want to waste any more time than he has to. So it's a shame, because it took a lot of gloss off. He came back to Australia and, you know, the press love a winner, don't they? So yep. everyone wanted to be involved with him, and he was getting a lot of mainstream exposure. And then 2.5 weeks later, his reputation is literally in the gutter. And, you know, it's an uphill battle. And, you know, I've been one of those people myself where someone proclaims their innocence on a steroid allegation or a drug allegation. I go, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. But now I'm on the other side of the coin, and I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. And we meticulously went through all of his vitamins and this and that. And we even got him to do a – we flew him to Sydney from Perth and got him to do a lie detector test like they do in America, and he passed that with flying colours. Not that that's worth a great deal, but it's part of the case that we were trying to put together.
Yeah, it's all about adding weight of evidence to what you're doing. The other thing you mentioned there about the press love a winner, but the press also don't like supporting a winner who then has made them look stupid. So did they quickly turn against him?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the WBA's resolution that they issued after the settlement from court, they eventually looked at our evidence. We had to take it to court to do that, but they looked at our evidence and have said that, yeah, the test is through no fault of his own. So finally he got his name cleared, but, geez, that took 6 months or something like that, and there's a lot of damage done between those 6 months. But admittedly, the press is now back on side again, and he's now the man that's been wronged. So in a bizarre way, it kind of, I don't know, it's sort of back on track. It's weird.
Now, again, around the time that your guy was in there, obviously, as I said, the Klitschko's were owned the world heavyweight title belts. And really, things in the last 12 months really, in the world heavyweight title scene have completely fragmented. And especially right now, one of the worst things as a boxing fan is looking from the outside, well, as a casual boxing fan, of trying to work out the politics which determine, you know, this fighter is with this TV channel, so actually he'll never fight that fighter because he's with Showtime and he's with HBO, so they'll never fight each other. And unless you are picking up the boxing press every day and reading it to be on top of who's with what station, sometimes you can just be a bit bemused as to what's going on. So, particularly now that obviously with Tyson Fury having to give up his belt, what is going on in the world heavyweight title scene, and who's your guy going to fight?
Well, that's a million-dollar question as well. You're right, though. Look, it is a mess. It's hard to explain to casual boxing fans. Obviously, when the public demands something enough, they'll usually get it. So regardless of HBO, Showtime, Sky Sports, any of those sort of things, if the public demand is there, they will fight each other. But it is a business, I suppose, at the end of the day, unfortunately. And sometimes that can prevent, you know, good fights being made. And Tyson Fury's been stripped. I thought when Fury beat Klitschko, I was ecstatic. I thought, you know, that would open up the heavyweight division, and it's great to have a breath of fresh air. I personally find Klitschko's style fairly boring. It's a jab and grab sort of. Oh, it's effective, though. It's very effective. But when Fury beat him, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. Heavyweight boxing's opening up. And obviously they got roped into a rematch and all that sort of stuff. And you know, all the listeners will know what's happened to Tyson Fury since. He's obviously got his own problems, and I hope he overcomes those mental problems and the drug-related issues as well. But yeah, it's hard because he's viewed as the guy that has beaten the guy that's beaten the guy. So
yeah,
he's a lineal champion, that's for sure. But now the belts are wide open. Anthony Joshua's obviously got the IBF title. He was a big name in Britain and Ireland. And Lucas, we're waiting to hear from the WBO who he's going to fight. So your guess is as good as mine. I thought at one stage it was leaning towards Vladimir Klitschko. There was talk between our camp and their camp. We were going to look to go to Hamburg in Germany and try and knock him out, I suppose. That was the plan, but it never eventuated. I think he had 1 foot with us and 1 foot in the Joshua Eddie Hearn camp as well. And after all of that, he's developed some sort of calf injury or something along those lines.
Because they were starting to mute the possibility of Joshua and Klitschko in December.
Yeah, but then which would have been a great fight.
So there does seem to be pockets of November, December time, January, February, March, April. There seems to be pockets of dates as to when these fights will take place in terms of fitting into TV schedules, etc. So do you have an idea of the timescale?
Yeah, that's exactly right, mate. Like at the end of the day, it is dictated by TV because TV brings the money. So obviously your gate, like all the live punters coming through, well, that's one thing, but the TV is where the real money is, and I believe December 10 was the date they were looking at for both Joshua and Klitschko, and then alternatively Klitschko and us in Germany. And every day that passed, I thought this isn't going to happen because they need weeks to promote it. You know, it takes time to promote it. So as it's turned out, that's exactly right. They're looking at March or April for Joshua and Klitschko again. So. We're just open to anything. The WBA will tell us who we've got to fight, and that's who it'll be. It could be Alexander Ustinov, who's from Russia, I believe, David Hay. Yeah, your guess is as good as mine at this stage, and until the WBA say that's who you're fighting, I really don't know.
So I take it if it was David Hay, it would be in the UK that it'd be happening?
That's correct, yeah. David Hay is obviously a household name, so we'd have no problems going over there, I think. Yeah, it'd be a good fight. It'd be a quick fight. Both of them, you know, both of them don't like going the distance. So, no.
I think you should get Lucas Brown, David Hay happening at Celtic Park.
I'd be up for that. weighing at the Brazen Head.
Yeah, exactly. I think you could create a niche market for a certain different type of fight taking place.
I'd be up for that. I'd definitely be up for that. Scotty Cardle on the undercard.
Yeah, so tell us about your other. I suppose it must be difficult as well with Lucas, not to be demeaning of him, but age is not on his side for all this to be dragging on either.
No, it's not. You're correct. But by the same token, look, he's 37, but he looks after himself. He doesn't drink. I'm not sure what's wrong with him, but he doesn't drink. He's a full time athlete, and he's only been fighting since he's 30. So even though he is 37. He doesn't have the miles on the clock, and he's never had any amateur contests, never boxed at all as an amateur. So he's not like one of these guys that's sort of had 200 amateurs and he's been sparring since he's 14 or 15 and all the rest of it. So whilst he is getting on, I think he's a little bit different to your average sort of 37-year-old pugilist. But, yeah, some of the other guys have got Damien Hooper. He made headlines in Australia. He wore the Aboriginal flag into the ring in the London Olympics. Mm-hmm.
How did that go down in Australia?
Yeah, most people were fine with it. Obviously, you're going to always have a small percentage of people that, you know, are narrow-minded and right-wing and all the rest of it. But, it made news, but the news reports on anything that's semi-controversial. So but the average person in the street were more than fine with it. He's representing his culture, and that's fine. Another kid, Cameron Hammond, who's fighting on the 25th of November for the Commonwealth welterweight title. Mm-hmm. So the Commonwealth title is it's held in high regard here in Australia, not so much anymore in Britain, but it's still viewed as a great title here in Australia, so hopefully he can secure that. They're the main three kids that I look after. Brandon Ogilvie's another kid. He's a lightweight. He's just sort of learning the ropes still. He's world-ranked, but we're taking our time with him. He's only young. He's 23, so...
So it must be this is one of the things that, you know, David Hay, for example, if I pick David Hay, he's come back from being 3 years out. And he's picked his opponents quite smartly. He's picked people with, on record, a good record.
Yeah.
But, so they've got, you know, whatever it was, 17-0 or whatever. But patently someone who has never fought anybody of any standing. So that David Hay goes in, fights a guy with a good, with a 17-0 record and knocks him down in a round and a half. Knocks him out in a round and a half.
Yeah.
Now that's fine for David Hay, who has been at the top and all he's looking to do is get three or four fights under his belt to get another world title fight. The challenge must be if you're bringing through a young fighter, that balance between giving him a challenge, which improves him, but not taking too much of a risk that you take him beyond his ability before he's ready.
Yeah, you're correct.
Is that the biggest challenge of a manager?
Absolutely. It's a bit of an art form, and I think I always get it right. But I think, like, my view is as well that it's okay to have a loss as long as you learn from a loss, as long as it's not a brutal knockout as well. But it is. It's a step. Like, your first, normally when you're turning professional, your first couple are sort of, for lack of better words, gimmies, and you find your feet, and maybe you're learning to box longer rounds, you know, six rounds as opposed to maybe three or four or whatever in the amateurs. But, yeah, you eventually want to start stepping them up to sort of more durable opponents that are going to give them a test and take them into deep water and make them think and make them work for the win. You're right. It's a hard thing to do. Some of it's calculated guesswork, for lack of a better word, or lack of a better phrase, I should say. But that's all you can do. You know, you can't always get it right. It's boxing. I mean, one punch can turn a fight, and all you can do is just watch as much footage as you can on the opponent and try and work out how your guy would go with him.
And that side of things, in terms of you said defeat's not the end of the world. I mean, I often think Brendan Rodgers learned more in one simple defeat to Lincoln Imps, and then probably learned massively about us playing Champions League football in the defeat in the Nou Camp than he would have done if we'd performed differently in both of those games. And it's interesting you say that a defeat's not the end of the world, because I do think sometimes boxing can be a really bad sport for one defeat is the end of the world. You look at a record sometimes of a guy who maybe he was never going to make it, but he maybe got to his 10th or his 11th fight winning, on a winning streak, loses. And then when you look at his record, you think, suddenly your promoter stroke manager started putting you in against people who were above you, and you've turned into a journeyman fighter that everybody knows. You win every fourth fight, but actually you're there because you're a tough bro, but you lose all the time.
Exactly right. It's like Simon and Garfunkel's song, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you're right. And I'm not much of a fan of the UFC, but one thing that they do well is, as long as you perform and put on a good fight, a loss is not going to be held against you. And I think sometimes you're spot on. A loss in boxing can be so detrimental for no real reason. As long as you perform and it's not a boring fight where people are like wanting to change the channel, to me it shouldn't be held against you.
Yeah, but it painfully is. Interesting you mentioned UFC fighting. I just can't get into it at all. I mean, I like my boxing, right? And at times, I mean, obviously there was the recent death of the Scottish fighter, and at times, as a rational grown-up male, I can be watching it thinking, really what's appealing to you here is a guy being knocked senseless.
Yep.
And there is a rational part of you thinks that way. UFC, it just seems far more brutal. There's a guy in the ground and they start laying into him.
I know. It sort of goes against everything you maybe stand for as a man, that when you knock someone down, you don't give them a kicking. I know what you're saying. But, you know, That's the way it is. There's obviously a market for it. And look, there's times myself where I've watched boxing, and as tragic as it is, I've watched fights where, you know, people have brain bleeds and have passed away afterwards, and you think, really? Is this actually a sport or not? You know, it's, yeah. It does make you think, that's for sure. But it is a contest. I look at the other side of the coin, you know, that it probably has saved a lot more lives than tragically have been lost. I think a lot of people have turned their lives around. A few of the kids that I manage tell me I'd be in jail without a shadow of a doubt if it wasn't for boxing. So, you know, instead they've gone to the Olympics and this and that. So I try and look at the other side of the glass. But, yeah, the UFC, look, I watch Conor McGregor because he gets me interested with his talk, but I don't watch a great deal of it, to be honest. I think the best part about the UFC is when they're standing up and boxing, so.
Yeah. So how did you get into it? How did you get into being? You talked about your granddad being a miner, your dad being a teacher. So has the grandson of a miner and the son of a teacher become a manager of Australia's first heavyweight champion?
For 2.5 weeks. yeah. Asterix. The asterix years.
But, yes, exactly.
the asterix weeks. what happened was when I got back from playing rugby over in Scotland, I was looking for a job, obviously, and almost as a joke, I wrote away to a promoter and said, look, I love boxing, this is the story, do you need someone to work for you? And he actually called me straight back and said, I'm looking for someone. And so I started working for this promoter, Jamie Meyer, down the Gold Coast, and he showed me the ropes, and, you know, one thing led to another, and I was matching fights and this and that, and I thought, well, why don't I manage some of these guys? I'm basically looking after them anyway, and it's like everything. You know, you start off, because you haven't got a name for yourself, you start off down low, and you do a good job for that guy, and then you climb the ladder and you progress, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, so, yeah, Lucas, I imagine, is the guy who's really brought you to your name to prominence, that's allowed you to get the Olympians that you talked about.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I'm thankful for the big fella. He keeps knocking them out. I line him up for him and he knocks them out, so it's great. and, you know, because of him, I've managed to get up to paradise probably 4 or 5 times. And after, you know, you'd fight down in Hull or Wolverhampton or one of those sort of beautiful places, and we'd get up the road to Glasgow as quick as we could. So,
Has Lucas been to Celtic Park then?
No, I need to drag him along. We keep talking about it, and he said next time he's going to come. So I might unleash him on the Gallagher just before.
Absolutely have to get this fight with. You have to get the fight with David Haye. That's who the fight's got to be. I granted it's not going to be at Celtic Park, although, you know, let's all do a crowdfunding to get it at Celtic Park. But it's not going to be Celtic Park. It'll be down at the O2 or something like that. Pre-fight, you've got to get Lucas up.
I think we can do that. I think we can manage that. It's only a short trip, so he keeps saying he wants to come. So yeah, I'll drag him up there.
So the other thing to touch on is, because you're a rugby league man, that the area you're from is rugby league, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a real working class sort of place. So rugby league is probably king where we are. Football's growing, don't get me wrong, but rugby league would be the number one game, I would say.
So were you a rugby league player?
Oh, not a very good one, but yeah, as a kid, I think pretty much everyone I knew played rugby league. So we played for the Brothers Club in Ipswich, which is sort of those who go to it's a past club for, you know, Catholic schoolboys team, that sort of thing. And just about all my family played for Brothers.
So what then gets you playing rugby union in Strathaven?
Yeah, I know, a strange one, isn't it? Well, the high school I went to was predominantly rugby union, which is strange, but it's just one of those sort of anomalies, I guess. But I went over to visit my relatives in Les Mahago, and they said, do you want to play a game for the local club? And I was like, oh, well, why not? And I ended up staying there for 2 years, and yeah, one thing led to another, and it was just a great experience. My cousins from here ended up flying over and playing as well, and another mate, and I think they had some rule over there, you're only allowed 2 imports per team, and we had to produce my granddad's birth certificate to prove that we were apparently Scottish. So,
and so how many years were you at Strathaven?
Just the two.
Just the two. And then you there was nothing that made you try and stay on in Scotland, or was it the weather rotten and you had to get back home?
Oh, I broke my arm pretty badly, so I wanted to make sure I got that all cleared up. But no, I loved it over there. I probably would have stayed if it wasn't for breaking my arm. But I've been back regularly since. I've been to Scotland maybe 10 or 11 times now. So, no, I enjoy it. I try and get back as often as I can.
So, how are you finding things under Brendan Rodgers?
Loving it. Absolutely loving it. It's a breath of fresh air. I watched the match this morning against Ross County. And I've got to say, I actually think the scoreline flattered us, to be honest. But, yeah, Brendan's just turned it all around, and he's done it so quickly.
Yeah, you were saying about the scoreline flattered us. I mean, not long before we scored the second goal, I get a text from my brother saying, how are we still in the lead in this game?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think if their finishing had been a little bit better, I think they could have taken something from that game, and I don't think we could have complained too much about it, but... Yeah, we put the foot down. I think it was Armstrong's goal that sort of sealed it. And after that, it was obviously the floodgates were open.
Yeah, the thing that really got me was the speed with which the game was played at last night. It just seemed to be getting played at a million miles an hour. There was no sideways pass in the middle of the park. Both teams, as soon as somebody got the ball, it was direct on goal.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of credit's got to go to Ross County. I think they made a real game of it. The scoreline, you know, if you didn't watch the game, you look at, say, 4-0 routine win for Celtic. But I think Ross County, you know, they probably gave an example of what other teams should be doing to us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they pressed our goalkeeper and back two when we were trying to play out from the back. And I think, what was it, 83rd minute, first minute of injury time and third minute of injury time, I think, was when the three goals were scored. So
yeah, that's right.
We've got we've Ross County and we've got Aberdeen at the weekend. So what time will... That's a midday or 12:15, can't remember which, kick-off. What time's that for you?
I think it's a 9:30 kick-off, 9:30 at night. So that'll suit. I'll be three or four beers in by then.
All right, so that's not too bad. So what's your prediction for Saturday?
Geez, I think it'll be a hard-fought game. I'm actually going to say it'll be 1-0. I think Aberdeen will be up for it. Yeah, I think they're always... It's at Pittodrie, I believe, so they're mm-hmm. always hard to beat up. I'm going to say 1-0.
And then... And who's going to score?
Well, it's hard to go past Dembele, isn't it? So I'll stick with him. I actually had a feeling that this morning, last night for you, I thought would have been the game that we were maybe going to drop some points. So I thought we might have had a bit of a hangover from the German team and the other team.
Yeah.
But... you know, I thought, despite that, you know, and despite making all those changes, you know, we had a good squad out there still. I was delighted that we got the 3 points.
My mate sent me he'd taken a screenshot of, I think it was a follow post, where somebody was saying, I've just seen the team that Celtic are playing. They can't keep winning games. And the team that they're playing, they're bound to drop points. If we beat St Johnstone, we are up to whatever place they were going to be. And then they're away at Pittodrie on Saturday, so there's a good chance they'll drop points there. And then we could be just behind them. If we win tonight and win on Saturday, we could be just behind them by the end of Saturday night. And then the narrative will have all changed. And yeah, that didn't go so well.
I can imagine. There's nothing better than deluded hands. I don't care what side of the world you're on.
So the last game before the break, following the Aberdeen game, is the Borussia Mönchengladbach. So obviously that didn't go so well at Celtic Park. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, quite obviously it's going to be hard over there. Look, I'll be happy with the point. I know it's the view of some people. I'm kind of happy just to even be in the Champions League. I know a lot of people will disagree with that and say we should be taking this amount of points at Celtic Park and this and that, but to me, I think we can build on that next year and the years to come with Brendan. I think, you know, we've established ourselves as a Champions League club now, again, or re-established ourselves, I should say. So, look, I'll take a draw over there. I'll take a sneaky win, but I really think we'll be up against it, to be honest with you.
So that's the Celtic. Very quickly, before we go back onto you, who's your next guy with a fight?
Well, luckily, I was going to say that, luckily we can always count on beating Barcelona at home, so that's...
So that's enough to be voice in the bag.
That's half of the course, right?
Exactly, and of course Man City, we broke Man City. Since Man City came to Celtic Park, they can't get a point off anyone. They can't get a win anyway.
Well, you know, I don't think we should fear them going away either. I think, you know, sticking up them again, we were brilliant at Paradise, so I don't see why we can't sort of replicate some of that form just down the road.
Well, historically, they don't perform well at the Etihad in the Champions League, and their fans, I believe it all stems to getting a £47 million fine 3 years ago from UEFA for breaking the fair play rules and having to go in with a squad two players down or something like that. They hate UEFA. That's why they boo the Champions League anthem, turn their back on it, and they don't sell out Champions League games.
Okay. I actually wasn't aware of that. But, yeah, I'd give ourselves a good chance down there. I think, you know, the players would be right up for it, knowing that we got a good result and probably should have won the game at Celtic Park. So why not?
Yeah, so there we go. We've got 7 points there. Three at home in Barcelona, three at dead in Manchester, and a draw in Germany. We're still... So who's your next guy up with a fight?
Look, it probably... actually, I've got Kerry Hope this weekend. Kerry Hope's from Merthyr Tydfil in Wales. He's fighting down in Sydney this weekend against an Aussie kid.
How'd you end up with a fighter from Merthyr Tydfil?
He immigrated to Brisbane.
Oh, so. Yeah.
He saw the light. I'm down to Sydney this weekend. After that, boxing pretty much closes. It's like in the UK, it pretty much closes down over Christmas and New Year. So that's about... after Cameron Hammond, who I've got fighting for the Commonwealth title on November 25th. After that, that's it for the year. And then Lucas will be up some stage, January or February, and he'll be on the door at the Brazen Head or similar, hopefully.
Honestly, if you can, do you know what? I'm absolutely certain, if you could get him up, I'm absolutely certain Celtic would get you and him on the park.
The Paradise Windfall.
Yeah. The very minimum you get to do is the Paradise Windfall.
It's been a dream for a long time.
With that, I will, one other thing, the final thing. On a more serious note, see, with what you went through, do you think the world governing bodies should boycott major fights in Chechnya?
Ooh, tough one. With Chagayev out of the picture now, because he's actually retired, so I don't even know if they will have major fights there anymore, because there's no real reason for them to have it. No, I'm not prepared to say that, because I think... for the most part, we were treated exceptionally well over there. We can't complain at all with how the people treated us. I think bad things like that can happen absolutely anywhere, and I can't really point the finger at one particular person and say that's who did it, because I don't know. But we do know that he was clean when he came into Chechnya. But mind you, there's allegations of that sort of stuff happening all over the world. So,
well, that was one of the things I was going to say, with those types of allegations, you know. Should they themselves, aware of them, not be more likely to do things like drugs test someone in their own country just before they leave, drugs test them, and do the type of hair sampling test? I suppose the argument against that would be, well, that then's a cheater's charter for somebody to be able to take a one-off enhancing drug just before a fight and say, well, I was clean before I went and clean after I came back, so it must have been the bad guys over there.
That's right. It's kind of like you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I know with clenbuterol, I've since found out with clenbuterol, you're meant to cycle it. So it's not something you sort of take once and it works wonders for you at all. So it really is. We said that we didn't want Rosada, who's the Russian anti-doping there, and that turned out to be a pretty smart move, obviously, after what's happened with the Olympics and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But we got... VADA involved, who are American based, so it was kind of it was our team that demanded the drug testing, so it didn't really make a whole lot of sense that this is the way it's turned out. But that's the way it goes. That's boxing, unfortunately. It's been a long uphill battle to clear his name. Finally, we're there, but
I mean, would the WBA sympathetic, or is it a bit of a... accede to what the position is and then pretend it never happened?
I think they were sympathetic to begin with because they only banned him for 6 months. Now, that sort of thing is usually a two-year ban.
Yeah.
So I think they knew from the get-go. This is my assumption. I don't have any of this, you know, documented, but my guess is that they probably thought, well, something's gone on. So, you know, here's 6 months. Now, you know yourself, a boxer at that level, they don't even fight for 6 months. Like, yeah. He'll have a holiday for 2 months without even going into a gym. So,
but we weren't happy with that. We said, no, that's not good enough. Like, we knew that he'd done nothing wrong. And, you know, we fought and paid a fair bit of money to clear his name. And eventually, with all the lawyers' fees and the testing and this and that, well, eventually we've cleared his name. And you've got to say it's worth it because it is.
Okay. Well, I will see Matt Clark with the... Very interesting. That was really interesting. From your grandfather arresting Rudolf Hess to your boxer being assaulted by the president of Chechnya and all things in between. I'll say, Matt Clark, we'll have you on again, and thanks very much.
Yeah, hi.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed that podcast. Hopefully not just because I'm a boxing fan. I found that really, really interesting, and we'll certainly be having Matt on again to discuss the confirmed date and opponent of his boy's fight for the WBA heavyweight title. Maybe it will be David Hayes Celtic Park, eh? Never know. Anyway, we have the Celtic FC Foundation stuff. The Christmas appeal has been launched, and the first chance that if you want to participate in the excellent work the Foundation does to follow in the footsteps of our founding fathers, then Sunday the 6th of November, the anniversary of the club's formation, they are asking the Celtic family to fast for the day in honour of the charitable heritage of the club and donate what you would have spent on the food. They're suggesting £5 to the Christmas appeal. So if you can give up food for that one day, that is Sunday the 6th of November, so that somebody facing hardship can enjoy a meal this Christmas. If you want to get involved, use the hashtag FoundingFathersFast. You can tweet Foundations CFC in advance to let them know that you're getting involved. And you can donate at the Celtic FC Foundation website, which is www.celticfcfoundation.com, or you can text CELT, C-E-L-T 07 or 1, so that's C-E-L-T 07 followed by £5, as in the pound symbol and the number 5, or whatever amount you want to give, if it was your whole family doing it and it was a bit more, to 770. So that's CELT 07 followed by the symbol 5 and a viva to 70070. And get involved in the Celtic FC Foundation Christmas appeal, which helps 250 local families facing poverty to provide a meal on the table and gifts for their kids. There is the Foundation Sleepout that you will know about the following weekend from that one. And then there will be the bucket collection on the December 17th game and various other things that's going on. So, want to get involved at Celtic FC Foundation. Anyway, enough of me. Playing underneath me is the Snuts with Proper. And there is also Glasgow that was on the beginning. And the usual links will be on the website. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, Matt Clark. And this is me saying good night. And God bless. Good night.
Be